Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
I believe in the power of imagination. I always believe that you can imagine different worlds, different societies, different, and even a different you, a different persona of you. So Locuela, my second novel, and in English, my third one in Spanish, I always say that I started this book thinking something so simple. What would happen if I, instead of going to the bar and having a beer with a friend, I would remain in my home place watching a movie? That small alternative makes two Carlos. And the world is full of different choices. You know? Every choice you do make you a different person.
We interpret life at moments of the deepest desperation. The insightful words of Chilean novelist, short story writer and essayist Roberto Bolaño from his iconic novel The Savage Detectives, published in 1998. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's great to have your company this evening. Can fiction change the world? And possibly the way we think too. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to ask that question with two thought-provoking and hugely original writers who took part at this year's ISLA, the Irish, Spanish, Latin American Literary Festival at the Instituto Cervantes in Dublin in October. This year's festival theme was borders. Mexican narrator, essayist and editor Alvaro Uribe unpacks the relationship between migration, words and borders. And Chilean novelist Carlos Labbé talks reinventing the novel. So is all writing a self-investigation and a journey into the unknown? First up, it's Carlos Labbé.
Hello, my name is Carlos Labbé. I'm a Chilean writer based 6 years now in New York. I published 7 novels now. 2 of them are in English now, Navidad and Matanza and Locuela, both of them in open letter books. A publishing house based in Rochester, New York. The third one, Coreografías Pelli Spiritual, still under translation process. It's forthcoming next year. You know, I've said in a couple of interviews that the writer should be a hacker of reality, meaning that the writer, we have a perfect position, perfect place to read reality. Not everyone in these times, a lot of jobs, a lot of work, a lot of time. Our time is reading. Our work is reading. So as a reader, we should be able to read all the linguistic construction that serves as systems of living, narratives, you know? So nowadays, we have a lot of narratives controlling our lives. So a writer should be the one who, in their novels, has to propose different kinds of living and using imagination to project better realities, better societies.
But that puts a great demand on the reader because while there's lots of readers out there who love experimental narratives and plots that move around and maybe different types of voices and so on, it also is quite a complex experience for a reader. It demands a lot of your intention. Mm-hmm. You sometimes have to reread certain parts of a novel or certain sections. Yeah. So you don't make it easy on the reader. Yeah. But should you as a writer, is that your job as a writer to make it easy?
Yeah, you have a point. I think with the years, I've learned that experimentalism is not a value itself. You know, you have to know what you want to achieve with the experiment. Nowadays, I'm wondering about realism. You know, realism, I'm aware that the most beloved novels in our time are realistic. Mm-hmm. When you hear a novelist that is popular, it's because people in our system has to work a lot, 9 to 5, 9 to 6. And they are, by the end of the day, they are tired. The cognitive capacities are not in the best shape in the evening or in the weekend when they are tired resting, when they approach to the book. So I think every writer has a moment of experimentalism, and then comes a moment of populism when you decide to be a cult figure or to speak to a broader audience. And now my next books are going to be not realistic, but they are intended to be read by the everyday worker. So the structure of the new books, in some way, are subtly experimental inside the realistic aesthetic.
I suppose there's a commercial reality hitting you in the face as well, sure. That if you write some sublimely vibrant experimental novel, yeah. That you're limiting yourself in terms of maybe not the value in the book, yeah, but exactly. The value to the publisher in producing the book.
Yeah. Well, to me, the reader is the most important thing. Mm. But at the same time, I'm always thinking that the reader is more intelligent than me, even if the reader is tired. But sometimes writers or editors, publishers, tend to think that readership is stupid. But at the same time, you can see how people love all sorts of movies. And movies, you can see the most popular and most complex TV shows, American TV shows, are based on flashbacks and time traveling and inside the story. So you get to the point that you have to differentiate among the way you present your narrative and how you construct the characters.
Yeah. Well, let's look at your third book, Loquela. It's, I think it's been translated into English. It's a very intriguing title. I think you got it from a French literary critic. And Loquela means a lot of different things. It's got multiple meanings. So you're really putting it out to the reader, aren't you?
Well, yeah, Loquela is a very old word that exists in every language. In the Middle Ages was very popular because in the Middle Ages, everyone was very religious. So Loquela in the Middle Age sense is when you are praying and you go into a very deep state like meditation or very deep praying state that you start listening to voices that you can legitimately think that those voices are God or angels or saints. But then Roland Barthes, the French philosopher of the 20th century, he took this concept and said, okay, we are not religious anymore in France, you know? But this concept of complete, insightful, and when you start listening to something else, you can use it when you're in a sentimental state of being, like when you are in love and you are being wounded by a lover. So you start obsessively thinking about what this lover did to you, even if you're not a lover still, someone you really like. So that person told you something, a phrase, a word that you don't even understand, but it keeps obsessing you and goes inside you in every moment of your day. So Loquela is also a state of emotion when you're so obsessed with someone that you can't keep talking about that person.
So what was the big question you were asking yourself when you were putting together this narrative? Because for some people could find it a little disjointed. Yeah. It's multiple narratives, multiple voices. There's multiple truths and multiple realities. So it's hard to really know who's reliable, who isn't.
Well, it starts as a detective novel, meta-narrative detective novel. So all my books, I want to be perceived in a literal way, in a very normal way. But then I invite the reader to go deep, but in a superficial way, it works as a regular detective novel. So there's this corpse at the beginning, and there's this detective that at the same time is writing a novel. But my main purpose of that is opening reality to all sorts of different linguistic realities. You know, nowadays it's so hard to find literature about a mystical state that is not related to a church, but still religious. I think a reality has a mystical quality. You can always talk with people that do believe in God or in any God, in any religion, but religious discourse is so private now. Mm. It's even incorrect to talk about that to anyone who's not aware of that. So in that moment, I was a student of literature. So every student is upset with their object. I was reading a lot. I was literally I was producing a lot of discourse that I didn't know what to do with that. And at the same time, I was really obsessed with a person. So I had these three obsessions. I am a religious person. I was obsessed with a lover, and I was obsessed with literature. So I say I have these three problems. What should I do with that? Kill a person, and build a mystery. In the novel, a big issue is what's the difference between a secret and a mystery? The difference is that secret, a crime secret, is that by at the end of the book, you will know the secret. The secret will be revealed. But a mystery will always remain a mystery.
But you're leaving it between the space, between the writer and the reader. That's the mystery, really, isn't it? Because it's all down to interpretation. Yeah. I imagine some of your readers will absolutely love that and think it rocks. Mm-hmm. And others will just go, would this guy ever let off?
Well, it's completely valid to think that literature is entertainment. But even in the most silly entertainment, you always look for something and look for something that goes beyond entertainment. Mm-hmm. And I'm aware of that feeling when you watch 3 hours of an absolute crappy movie that you start watching it because you felt that something could relate with you there. And it's always that promise, and they never fulfill the promise. Mm-hmm. And it's a void when you finish. It's like eating a McDonald's sandwich. It looked yummy, but now I felt very bad. So I believe that literature would never have had to be like that. You have to fulfill your promise, but not in a story-driven way. Mm. So even if you fulfill a story, you can then have the void. So you have to promise a meaning, because by the end, we live in a world where there's a lot of battles between promises of meaning. You have a promise of meaning, like sensual promise. And even depends on the day of the week. If Saturday night or Friday night is always a promise of going out in a bar, meeting someone, partying, and you can fulfill your life with sensual living. But Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, when everyone is a little bit down because the week is starting, you can be a little bit more mystical. It's, I'm all by myself. I have to grasp my deep beliefs. So by Wednesday or Thursday, you say, okay, maybe the meaning is in social life. Let's go watch a drama piece. Let's go to the movies. Let's go to a bar. And you meet with friends.
Carlos, I have to ask you, you've been compared to one of the greats of Chilean literature, Roberto Bolaño. What is that like? It must be a huge compliment. But then again, it must also be a lot of pressure, because Bolaño really put Chile and Chilean literature on the map, didn't he?
Well, Bolaño is a very admired author in Latin America and Europe. But an interesting thing about Bolaño is, you know, Borges is a very important figure, but it's not popular at all. And at the same time, he was a great reader of Borges, and in some way he uses a lot of techniques by Borges. But at the same time, he has like a vitality he took from mostly the beatniks, the big poets like Yeats or Neruda, or even, you know, French poets. So in some way, Bolaño is the moment in world literature when Borges and Kerouac, or Ginsberg, more Ginsberg than Kerouac, they mingle in a new detective novel, because Bolaño was always about detective novels. That was the new aesthetic that Bolaño so successfully imposed to the world. But at the same time, Bolaño came from a generation, political generation of the 60s, that in Latin America, in all the world, were so politically engaged. And in the 90s, they went to bankruptcy, ideologically bankruptcy. And so Bolaño is part of that. So in some way, you can see Bolaño as the main writer that, by the end of the 20th century, beginning of 21st century, he constituted the loser rhetoric. Mm. So he was always saying, okay, we had it all. We were young, we were free, we were politically engaged. We could have transformed our societies. In Chile, you know, we had the revolution of Allende, the first and only democratic communism model that was overthrown by Pinochet. And so it's a trauma. And Bolaño was, in a small part, participating in that. But the problem with Bolaño now is that now he's part of the old paradigm. And now, from 2011, it came a new paradigm. So everything repoliticized in the world.
Yeah. But he certainly and so effectively ripped up the rule books and challenged what crime fiction was yeah. And is,
yeah.
and it did it in a very unique and savvy way. Can I ask you, and it's a very troubling aspect of Chilean society, it's the treatment of Indigenous in Chile. I was in Chile several years ago, and it's something that won't go away. And we see this in Canada, we see it in lots of different countries all over the world. Yeah. But it is a particular problem in South and Central America, how Indigenous communities are treated, and terrible issues with land grabs and human rights. That must be very difficult for educated Chileans to reconcile with. If you travel to Santiago and some of your other cities, it's very sophisticated, you've wonderful cultural spaces, yet there is the shadow of how the Indigenous are treated and continually treated.
Yeah, well, right now, to be fair, there's a war made by the Chilean state against the Mapuche indigenous. In the south of Chile, police are killing Mapuches. So that has to be in record. You have to talk about that. But at the same time, it's not prestigious talking about that. Bolaño, for instance, he never even told the word indigenous, Mapuche, because he was a urban writer. So that's why Bolaño is not really a popular author in Chile or even in Latin America. It's always a thing about elites. And even in the States or in Europe, it's not really a popular. It's not García Márquez. You know why? Mm-hmm. Or Gabriela Mistral, you know? Mm-hmm. You know why? Because he was always talking to the elite, talking about the white colonized elite. But García Márquez, for instance, is a mingle of indigenous tradition, European tradition, and all the mixture. So right now, the writer, the fiction writer in Chile, it has to be responsible for the environment. Chile, all Latin American countries, all the American countries, we have a big territory, beautiful places, big spaces with a lot of resources, water, mines, and it has been treated in a very unfair way by the governments. And writers traditionally don't want to talk about that. I do talk about that. I have a novel, Piezas Secretas Contra el Mundo. It's all about how can you do an ecologist novel without being politically correct.
Yeah. And Barbara Kingsolver, an American writer, yeah. has done that so cleverly.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering that all across South and Central America, whether we look at Colombia, where we look at Paraguay, Chile, all these wonderful countries, El Salvador, Honduras,
yeah.
you have large indigenous populations,
yeah.
but we don't seem to read their stories. We read their stories in indigenous cultural places, in museums,
yeah.
but it hasn't come through in the mainstream. What does that say about writers?
Yeah, well, the first thing they say is that most people in Latin America, we are mixed.
Mm.
We're mestizos, we are mixed people, but all the surnames are European. My own surname is French, Labé is French, but I don't have any French background.
Mm.
And at the same time, I'm sure that I have a lot of indigenous background that is not on paper. That's the problem. There's a very good theory by an Uruguayan, Angel Rama. The title of his book is The Lettered City. So his theory, and that's a perfect way to understand Latin America, is that when the Spaniard came and conquered and colonized and destroyed all the previous civilizations, they imposed the written culture. But you had to be a good Spanish writer. You had to know how to write. And all the indigenous cultures, they don't have writings. It's different than Chinese, all European cultures, even Indian. You know, all the indigenous, they didn't need to write. That's a different question. Why they didn't need to write? So all these languages were like captured by the European way of having everything in paper. So in order to have a prestige, in order to have power, you have to be a written person, a cultured person. But now there's the question of the cultural appropriation, you know. Being a person from Santiago de Chile, the metropolis, that is not the south or the north of Chile, where's the main indigenous population. And I don't have really, I'm not a part of, because the indigenous people, they live in concrete communes. So they are communitarians. They depend on families and clans. But they didn't have the time to evolve in time like you guys in Ireland.
But if we look at Paraguay as an example, the Paraguayans seem to have done it so much better, because when you visit Paraguay and you go to Asuncion or Mexico, you get bilingual signs, you get, you get indigenous signs as well as the colonial language, and there is a meeting. So it seems...
But in Chilean literature, there's something that... That's why we have some powerful poets. We have a big unconscious. Mm. This part of the mind, according to Freud, we have a very charged unconscious.
Which comes from the indigenous culture.
Comes from the indigenous and comes from the centuries and millennia of injustice that we, the, among quotes, white Latin Americans, we are always doing to the indigenous population and other minoritized people, even women, we are one of the countries where we don't have a legal abortion. We don't have a divorce is very recent, like here maybe in Ireland. So this big unconscious is so charged that the best Chilean writers, they always had some difficulty in being story driven, in being clear, in have a very light syntax. So José Donoso, Diamela El Cid, even some parts of Bolaño, they're so baroque. It's not guilt. It's a way to contribute to bring the ghosts of the indigenous people that they are not allowed to talk. And you have to be very careful to not to use their stories, their folklore. In some way, you have to be careful not to talk instead of them or giving my voice to them, using my voice to them. They use my voice. That's cultural appropriation. So you have to be careful and... in some way, be very elusive, but open the page to this charged nation.
Carlos, last question for you. Yeah. A. Carlos has made an appearance in a couple of your books. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, what are you doing there? And does that throw a lot of your readers off? Yeah. Because presumably they're wondering, is this you infused with it? Yeah. So why did you do that?
Well, I think it's a good way to engage the reader, like... making a small like a strategy that you may think that this Carlos is me, and in some way it is me because it's a projection. I believe in the power of imagination. I always believe that you can imagine different worlds, different societies, different and even a different you, a different persona of you. So Locuela, my second novel, and in English, my third one in Spanish. I always say that I started this book thinking something so simple. What would happen if I, instead of going to the bar and having a beer with a friend, I would remain in my home place watching a movie? That alternative makes two Carlos. And the world is full of different choices. Every choice you do make you a different person.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's great to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're meeting writers, novelists and teachers who gave a range of stimulating and challenging workshops, readings and talks at ISLA, the Irish Spanish Latin American Literary Festival at the Instituto Cervantes in Dublin in October. Next up, it's Mexican narrator, essayist and editor Alvaro Uribe.
Alvaro Uribe, I'm from Mexico, actually from Mexico City, and I've written, let's say, about 12 books, a couple of them short stories, then 6 novels, and then a few books of personal essays. Unhappily, none of these books is translated into English.
Alvaro, I am... I'm going to throw you a big wide open question to start off with, and shall we see where we go with that. Do you think you can judge a nation by its fiction? Do you think that's a fair assessment to say?
Yes, I would. If someone wants would want to go to Mexico, for example, I would advise him or her to read Pedro Páramo. That's a beautiful novel by Juan Rulfo, the name of the author. And I think one book or a few books, they capture the soul of a nation insofar as a nation has only one soul. Nations tend to be a little bit more complicated than oneness. Mm. Not many nations have many souls. Mexico doesn't have just one. But the main soul of the nation would be captured by this book, yes.
Mexico is such an intriguing city to walk around, and it has a very bad reputation for crime and violence. But the city itself is so charming. It's a very unexpected space, but it's beautiful to walk around, isn't it?
Well, I was born there. I still live there, and I find it fascinating. Not always beautiful. There are zones in the city that are not actually very nice to look at, but there's always something interesting. The people in the city, it's a city that's so alive. And it has many, well, of course it can be violent, but I don't think it's the most violent city in the world, and it's certainly not the most violent city in Mexico. Mm. Mexico has a lot worse cities. So as a tourist, I would feel more or less safe to walk there. I'm actually a walker. Normally people in Mexico City tend to use cars. That's the main drag about Mexico City, the quantity of cars that go through the city at every hour. But if you walk in the city, it's really a beautiful place to be.
You studied philosophy in university, and I know that your special interest was John Locke, and he had a lot to say about the mind and the imagination and the spaces we go into. I'm just wondering, how did his mindscape impact on how you look at the world and maybe how your responsibility as a writer within it to share certain types of stories?
Well, I studied philosophy. I knew I wanted to be a writer and a fiction writer, but I just didn't want to study that. I thought that if I studied very professionally Spanish and Latin American literature, I would come to hate that kind of literature because of having to do it forcefully in the school. So I decided to study something that would not make me anything. Professionally, a philosopher, what's that? It's really difficult to define a philosopher. I would define him or her as a person who knows how to read very difficult texts and who knows how to write clearly about these difficult texts. So actually, what philosophy taught me or teaches you or can teach you is to read and to write. It seems very elementary, but no, nobody knows how to read or write. And this very special way of reading intricate texts has allowed me to have a different view on literature. I tend to understand a little bit more than my colleagues who didn't study philosophy. I tend not to be amazed or in awe with difficult texts.
I know that Locke thought that, or certainly put out, that it's how we think what makes what we read ours. He's got a point, hasn't he?
Yes, of course. Sartre, also the French philosopher, when he went blind before dying, and when he went blind, he stopped writing, and he said, "Now I cannot think, because for me, to think is to write. What I don't write, I'm not thinking." And I would agree with that. And that's also, that's a very philosophical point of view. Whatever can be thought, it means it can be expressed. If you cannot express a thought, it's nonsense. Then you were not thinking. You were maybe feeling or dreaming or whatever. But if you think, necessarily you have to be able to express it.
It's consoling and directional at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah. It's consoling and terrifying, no, of course. Yeah.
Now, Alvaro, you have brought out a very unique collection of writing from Mexico. You've got, I think, 16 writers born and bred in Mexico. They have all been born after 1945.
Yes.
It's a bilingual collection of stories from both rural and urban Mexico. You've got the very sublime stuff, the very thinking stuff, but you've also got some gritty, violent stuff and some kind of more political tones to it as well. Can you tell me about the collection?
Yes, it was a project very interesting because we did it at the same. We did it for the United States. I work for the National University of Mexico. I'm an editor for the National University, and the idea was that Mexico would do an anthology of modern actual short story, and the United States would do the same thing to be published in the other country. Mm-hmm. And the very special thing about this project is that it's bilingual. Normally, only poetry is published bilingually because of the space you need to publish prose bilingually. And this one is bilingual. So it's good not only for people who actually don't know how to read in Spanish, but for people who don't know these stories also in English. So you can read, even a professor, for example, could use it. That's the whole idea. And the way I chose the writers, well, I do not think that I know all Mexican contemporary literature. It's absolutely impossible. There's so many good writers. So I tried to make lists of writers and finally arrived to 16 that for me were not necessarily the best, but who had very special short stories. And I made them help me to the anthology. I told them to pick up two of their very best short stories, and I chose the one that would combine better with the others. So it's actually, if you read this book, you can have a fairly exact idea of what's happening in fiction writing in Mexico.
But yeah, I was about to ask you that point, that in ways do you think that you can pick up a collection of short stories like what you've published and actually transport yourself mentally, socially, culturally, psychologically, or whatever frame of reference you want to put on it, into a country? Do you think it's possible to pick up a book and to travel to that country, to experience a country, almost as if you've loved it and slept through the country?
Oh, yes. Well, you can actually do it for Ireland and for Dublin with Ulysses. Well, with Ulysses, there's these excursions I've never been able to go on Bloomsday.
No? That
you follow whatever happens in the novel, you follow it, and you're actually knowing a whole town because of just one book. Of course, you can do it. We don't have a book that special about Mexico City, but many nice novels would do for towns. It's much more difficult for a country like Mexico, which is about 2 million square kilometers in size, so it's many times Ireland, and so it's very difficult with very, very different people. So I don't know if there's one book that actually covers the whole of what Mexico is. The north of Mexico is very different from the south. The north of Mexico, the indigenous populations were not as urban as those from the south. So what developed after the Spaniards conquered Mexico, it's quite different. You could even say it's almost two different countries, one more modern, more open, more less rooted to its past. And then the south of Mexico is very, very Indian, very, I wouldn't say not modern, but it's very traditional. And people speak very differently also, no?
Very atmospheric.
Yeah.
It's funny though, on the flip side of what you're saying there is that you can pick up a book from, it could be from a Colombian writer, a Uruguayan writer, a Chilean writer, and you can be so bamboozled and enchanted by the book that you will want to visit the country, you will want to buy the music, you will want to eat the food, walk the streets, smell the air. And it can actually be quite a disappointing experience because the writer has charmed you, they've described something.
A writer is a liar. Don't forget that. it's a very special kind of lies. We lie so that we can show the reader another level of truth. But we lie. We lie. Yeah. You can do whatever, and not only in the bad sense. I mean, we're not only lying to enhance, to beautify our countries. We also lie to make more horrible the horrible things. Mm. So you might be disappointed also in that sense. That, for example, you go to Mexico and you expect us all to carry guns and be killing it. Everyone kills everybody in Mexico City, and it doesn't happen.
Well, what about Mexican noir?
Yes. Well, it's the most horrible thing. Mexican presidents only can govern for six full years, and then they have to go out. And the last president, that's about 10 years ago, he decided to wage an open war on narco traffic, on criminals in general. And it has turned out very, very badly because it has actually made the criminals stronger. So in any given day in the Mexican newspaper, you read of about 15 different violent deaths. That's a lot. That's more than a country with a war that's mm-hmm. declared. Mexico is officially not in war, but our casualties are mm-hmm. as if we were in Iraq.
I'm just wondering about your president, Enrico Peña Nieto. How much of a handle does he have on security in the country? Now, I know he's seen as very much a reformer and he's championing human rights and he's had a big crackdown on criminality. But when you looked at over 100,000 Mexicans have lost their lives in the drugs war over the last 10 years, it's almost hard to get your head around. And we look at actually there's some parts of Mexico where the police officers don't actually patrol the streets because it's in no-go zones.
Yeah. Well, there's parts of Mexico where the police work with the criminals, not against the criminals, and that's really worrying and very difficult to control. Now and then you have the idea, the feeling being there, being Mexican, that the government has a little bit lost it. That a government, the least a government can do is to control the territory and to guarantee the peace, the peaceful lives. And certainly the Mexican government right now, it's not doing that, not in the whole territory. There are parts of Mexico where it has control, but large parts where it doesn't have control.
And so no real rule of law then, is it?
It's, there are some places where the narco, the criminals, actually govern. And they build hospitals, they build schools, or they as if it were an independent country. You don't know, when you think about it, you don't know if it's better to leave them alone and let them go on building schools and hospitals, because the government doesn't do it.
So the narco traffickers are also doing philanthropic gestures to the community. Mm-hmm. So that makes them almost quite untouchable then.
Yeah. Before, it is said, I'm not a specialist on the subject, but it is said that before the last 10 years, the Mexican governments actually negotiated with the criminals. They sort of divided the territory and they established clearly, you can do that and that here, but only that and only here. And the rest of it, you leave it alone. And it sort of worked. Mm-hmm. Once the war was declared, mm-hmm. there are no laws anymore. So they go, and it's going worse and worse, because you would think that since they are called narco, they are only doing narcotics, but that's they are doing any kind of crime. Okay. For example, extortion. That's mm-hmm. that's very common, and that's completely destroys the economy of a place. Mm-hmm. If you have you have a pub, mm-hmm. one guy will come and ask you for 100 euros a week, and if you don't pay it, you're shot. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. That's not narco, no. That's only criminals. Like you can imagine, it's like Chicago and Al Capone, no.
But kidnapping, intimidation, as you're saying, extortion. For the average Mexican who is living on a basic industrial wage, they don't have the privilege of security gates protecting their houses, and there is the privileged middle class and upper class in Mexico who can afford private security, gated houses, and all the protections that come with money. So there's almost two worlds, really, isn't there?
Yes, and it has also influenced. There's these two worlds, maybe three, because there's also the world of the peasants who are actually planting the drug, and they are in a way slaves of the criminals. They not only don't have protection, but they must give one, for example, one family has to give one son to the criminals. So this poor young man becomes a criminal himself. So it's very difficult. Very often when people are killed by criminals, you don't know their names. And that's terrible for a writer, but for a person in there. But it's terrible. It's they don't have names because they don't have families, because the families don't dare to reclaim the bodies, because then the narco would kill them also. So let's say that most of the killings are not done by the government against narcos, but it's criminals against themselves. So it's like petty warlords who are fighting their own private wars.
I have to ask a question, and it's probably a little left field, but I hope you let me away with it. What is it like sharing your name with the former president of Colombia? I imagine it has presented you as a writer with some interesting scenarios, but I'm just wondering, have you ever milked it?
It's horrible. I was in Colombia six years ago in Bogota for a book fair. And the very first thing that happened is that some citizen, a Colombian citizen, wrote to the newspapers saying, how can Álvaro Uribe, he was the president then, how can Álvaro Uribe dare to mingle with writers and say that he's a writer and present a book? So the Mexican delegation, the Mexican government who had invited me, had to write, back saying, no, he's a Mexican writer. He's not good. And then I was in a round table with some Colombian writers. I don't remember their names. So I participated. I said my thing. Just after I spoke, one of them started thinking. He kept quiet for a few seconds and he said, well, I'm going to do something I thought I would never do. I will agree with Alvaro.
But so, if you put in Alvaro Uribe into any search engine on the internet, let's say Google, for example, the guy has quite a hairy, interesting past, to put it mildly. Yeah. So I imagine somebody who doesn't actually see the cover of your passport could get a little bit uncomfortable meeting you if they just went, oh, we've got Alvaro Uribe in the room here, and they do a quick, simplistic search on the internet and go, oh, right.
No, yeah, it happens. Every time someone meets me outside Mexico, in Mexico, no, because it's not that I'm that well known, but I am known, and Álvaro Uribe, the Colombian, is not that well known. But out of Mexico, immediately the question arises, are you Colombian? So I joke about it. What can I do?
One thing I have to ask you is that in a couple of days' time, we're going to have the US presidential elections. Yeah. And one of the candidates, Donald Trump, has said so many offensive, astonishingly crude, if not downright outrageous comments about Mexicans. These broad sweep comments that Mexicans are all drug dealers and criminals, that we need to build a big wall, and he wants to get all the other Mexicans out. How can any Mexican cope with that constant barrage of abuse? It is so bloody frightening, isn't it?
Well, for us, it's a nightmare. Because we share, you know, about 3,100 kilometers of border. And actually, he's so ignorant, this bastard, that there's actually a wall for about 1,000 kilometers long. There is a wall, and people just manage to pass. And walls are nothing against people. Actually, 40% of the Mexicans that go to the United States with the intention of staying there illegally, they go by plane. So you can imagine that the wall would... So it's more irritating that he's talking about nonsense about Mexico, but he's also saying a very nonsensical thing about the way of stopping us. And we have I don't know, numerous agreements to collaborate in almost every possible field. We're neighbors. He couldn't do without Mexico. So it's absolutely stupid and very irritating. In Mexico, you can imagine that you mention Trump, and it's not, I don't know, like mentioning hell. No?
But to dismiss a nation who has such a rich repository of culture, of arts, the history is just so astonishing and so beautiful.
Yes, well, Mexico has very bad experiences with the Americans since our independence. Not many people know. Mexico was 4,000 square kilometers big. That means, no, 4 million, I'm sorry, 4 million. It was the double in size. Mm-hmm. And half of it was California, Utah, Texas, all of that was part of Mexico, and they took it in a war in 1848. Yeah. So you can imagine.
San Patricio.
So we are really irritable when it comes to America. So it's really bad, because it goes both ways. Yeah. I mean, most Americans simply don't know anything about Mexico. Some Americans just despise Mexico or hate Mexico like Trump. But it's also true that many, many, many Mexicans, the biggest majority, don't know anything about the States either. And that the Americans are not especially liked either in Mexico. So it's a little bit stupid. It's like hating your neighbor. It's stupid, because we cannot move. I mean, what can we do?
Can I ask you, there have been such an interesting wave of new contemporary writers emerging from the kind of shadows of the Carlos Fuentes of the world. And I'm just wondering, the likes of Martin Solares and other writers, is there going to be a future for those type of writers globally? Do you think that the dominance of the English language and all the cultural prejudices that go with that, do you think we're moving beyond all those borders?
No, of course not, because there's a natural, let's call it natural, border between the languages. Mm. And I hope we're not going to a future where there would be only one language, whether it be English or Spanish, I don't care. But why having, it's so rich to have many different languages. Mm. And each language, it's a universe, actually. It's a very different way to look at the universe. Mm. And I think it's actually a better world where we have many languages and not only one. But on the very immediate level, the English-speaking world speaking as an editor, I am an editor, is almost impossible to open. It's really, really difficult. Maybe 1% to 2% of the books that you read in English are translations. The rest of them were written originally in English. To make a comparison, the books you read in Spanish, maybe 20% are translated. So we translate 10 times more than you do. And most of the translations come from English. Of course, because of the importance of the American market, but you can, you in Ireland, you can profit from that. Irish writers are really well known abroad. So it has nothing to do with the quality of the writers. It has to do strictly with the market.
And when you think there that all the ideas that were missing within that.
Oh yes, of course. Then think again. I'm missing also Hungarian literature, or I don't know anything about Chinese literature, or we're always missing something, of course. And it's quite impossible for a single human being to be knowledgeable in every world literature. So there's tendencies, there's, as I tell, market tendencies, but also quality tendencies. You have, in English, it's not only the power of the American market or of the English-speaking market, it's also the quality. You have many good writers. For example, I was reading just before coming here John Banville. I love him. I think he's one of the very best writers writing actually in the whole world, not only in the English language. So he deserves to be read in Mexico. Well, I read him in English, but I mean, he deserves to be translated. And
but there's a beauty to that, because it just shows you that literature can move beyond borders, can't it?
It can, of course. Yes.
And on a personal level, what is your hopes for the future for Mexico?
Well, my hope would be that the war would stop, no? Of course. And one way of stopping it, so it's part of my hope, is that the inequality that's so very palpable, visible in Mexico would disappear. Mexico has the poor and the rich are really, really completely apart in ways almost unimaginable from Europe. And if people were not so poor, they would not go and become criminals. No, almost nobody becomes a criminal because he likes violence. Some people do. But most of the people become criminals because it pays much more than being decent and being honest. So if it was a country more egalitarian, more developed, I think the narco would go. It would reduce quite a lot. So that would be my hope. It's not too much to ask, no?
Thank you.
was Mexican essayist and editor Alvaro Uribe. The Best of Contemporary Mexican Fiction, featuring 16 of Mexico's finest fiction writers born after 1945, is edited by Alvaro Uribe and is available from the Jorky Archive Press for in around 15 euros. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Miriam and Lara at the Instituto Cervantes and all the Isla Festival team for all their help putting together this evening's show. We've been talking books. Go easy, be well, and in the words of Mexico's finest poet, Octavio Paz, deserve your dreams. Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.